At an atomic level, uranium is the heaviest element in nature, and because it has 92 protons all jammed into one nucleus, it's also the most volatile. In his new book, Uranium, War, Energy, and the Rock That Shaped the World, Tom Zollner takes an intimate look at this paradoxical mineral that could bring about Armageddon, but also has the potential to save the planet from global warming. The book is published by Viking, and I'm very pleased that it brings Mr. Zollner to the show today. Hello.
Hello.
You call uranium a geologic original sin. What do you mean by that?
Well, this is, as you pointed out, a nucleus that just can't hold together. This represents in some ways, you might call it a transgression almost. It's constantly falling apart, and this is what gives it its enormous power.
But it's not falling apart on the most, if I look at it, is it?
It is, actually. You can't see it, but it is. Its nucleus is shedding parts of itself, and this is what we call radiation.
What does raw uranium look like when it's pulled out of the ground?
It depends on what it's what kind of oxide it's bonded with, but it really looks quite unremarkable. It's
yellow dirt?
Yeah, just like gravel.
Would it be dangerous for me to handle because of that radiation?
Only if you ground it up and breathed it.
Uh-huh. So as long as it's bonded to something else, it's kept fairly stable?
Yeah, it is in a largely stable condition, so that's true. You wouldn't want to inhale the dust, but otherwise many of the uranium miners I met in conjunction with this research, you know, there's a common saying that they have that they'd shovel it into a pillowcase and sleep on it.
Where on the periodic table is uranium? It's not at the very end, is it?
It's up there. It's as you pointed out, one of the heaviest elements found in nature, and certainly the heaviest one that's found in great abundance. It appears in the Earth's crust at 40 times the rate of silver.
Are the other ones also unstable?
Yeah. As you get up the periodic table, the inner architecture of the nucleus just can't hold together. And so there is a great deal of instability up there in the periodic table.
No, it does break down.
It does break
down. How long is its half-life?
Uranium's half-life? You know, I don't know that off the top of my head, I have to confess. It remains fissile, if you like. It keeps that unstable condition for upwards of 700 million years.
Mm. 12.5, I am informed, which is a lot. Oh, 12.4 million. Oh, whatever. 4.5. It's 4.5.
Yeah, a billion here, a billion there, and suddenly you're talking about real years.
Yeah, we're talking about real half-lives. But it breaks down into lead, doesn't it?
Eventually, yes.
Which I find really fascinating because the alchemists of the Middle Ages thought that you could convert lead into gold, and it turns out you can turn uranium into lead.
That's a good analogy, and this is a weird kind of natural alchemy, you might call it.
Aren't both uranium and plutonium used in nuclear weapons? What's the difference between them?
That's correct. A uranium bomb was what was dropped on Hiroshima. This was the first nuclear shot fired in anger, you might say, and it essentially involved two pieces of uranium slammed together at great velocity. And this it's no great secret. That's what the essence of an atomic weapon is. Plutonium is a bit of a different story. It has to be, as we did over Nagasaki and also at the Trinity test site, it has to be compressed into itself.
So it's more difficult to work with than uranium?
It is much more difficult to work with.
So why do we even bother?
With plutonium?
Yeah.
It is yet another route to that chain reaction that releases enormous destructive power.
Mm-hmm. So it's once you get the thing into the bomb, it's more effective.
Plutonium? Not necessarily. And this is one of the things that happened with the Manhattan Project is the decision was made at a high level to pursue two paths to atomic potency. And we spent $2 billion, we the United States, during this intense industrial effort. And we arrived there at the same destination two different ways.
But if I were a renegade country right now, wanting to develop my own bomb, would it be better for me to just stick with uranium?
It's easier to machine. It's easier to acquire. Certainly, I think uranium poses the greater threat.
When did humans first come in contact with it? Because it occurs naturally in nature.
It does occur in nature, and stained glass containing uranium has been found that dates to the first century A.D., and it first emerged into the world as a recognized element in the 1500s in Bohemia.
But miners would call it the bad luck rock.
Yeah, this is one of the ironic features of its history is that it was regarded as a nuisance. It was seen as an impediment to the silver mining that they were doing in that mountain range in present-day Czech Republic.
And did it eventually have health risks?
It did. In fact, they were in the habit of tossing it off into the forest, creating these piles of uranium, and they would go down into these twisty-turny caverns, which I've been down in. You know, they still exist with some of the original boreholes there in the Czech Republic, which was then Bohemia, and to be in that confined space, breathing that uranium dust that I was talking about earlier, this created a high fatality rate, and no one could figure out why.
Is there still a lot of uranium in Bohemia?
There's
because it hasn't been 4.5 million years since it was first found.
There are trace amounts. Much of it was mined by the Soviet Union, which turned that that 16th century mine into a gulag, into a prison camp.
Where is most of the uranium we mine found today?
Canada is the world's largest producer, followed closely by Australia.
Is all uranium the same? When it's found in nature, is it the same in Canada as it was in Bohemia or in Africa?
Yeah, when you can reduce it down to its purest state, yes, it is the same. Now, I have to talk about the isotopes of uranium, and this isotope is Greek for in the same place, and this essentially means that the weight differs by a very, very small difference. There's U-235, which is what you really want for the weapon, and there's U-238, which might be regarded as the chaff around the wheat, if you like.
So we have to actually create U-235?
We have to separate it out from the U-238. It occurs at a ratio of about 1 to 140, and this process is known as enrichment. And this is a matter of great interest internationally as to who is enriching uranium.
So that's what we're right now concerned about with Iran, for example, whether it is trying to create U-235 or not.
That's the heart of the problem with Iran, yes.
You describe the dispersion of U-235 around the world to a drop of snake venom that loses its ability to kill when dissolved in gallons of water. What do you mean by that?
Well, like I said, uranium in its natural state is a stable substance. It would be really good for nothing. If you wanted to ground it up into gravel and pave your driveway with it, I suppose you could. But you certainly couldn't make a bomb. You would have to separate it out. You'd have to take advantage of that minute weight difference in between 238 and 235 for it to be of any use.
My guest is Tom Zollner. He's written a number of books, including one with Paul Rusesabagina called An Ordinary Man, which brought its subject to the show some years back. And now we have the co-author here talking about uranium, war, energy, and the rock that shaped the world. It is published by Viking. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. When did scientists start realize that this thing could be used to actually do something more than just sit there and be and create some kind of radiation sickness?
This is one of the fascinating stories in the history of science, the way that there was this gradual awakening across the world, that dozens of scientists in Europe and America came almost to a collective realization that what's called a chain reaction is possible with uranium. And so one person cannot be said to have, quote-unquote, discovered the atomic bomb. It was a collective effort.
But wasn't the Austrian physicist Otto Frisch the first to discover that a single atom of U-235 can make a grain of sand twitch?
Otto Frisch and his aunt did breakthrough work on this in 1938, and they were the first ones to really demonstrate that not only was a chain reaction possible, but that the uranium atom was going to be very special in this regard.
And he was an Austrian, but he left Austria when Hitler became a threat. He suggested the destructive power of uranium to the British government. Why didn't they listen?
The British actually listened a great deal more than the United States. The Roosevelt White House was very, very slow to pick up on the implications of this.
Is it true that it took the Einstein letter to actually make them aware of the possibility?
That played a role, but it was not solely due to the Einstein letter. It actually got caught in the wheels of bureaucracy for more than a year after Albert Einstein wrote to President Franklin Roosevelt and urged him to devote the enormous industrial capacity of the United States towards this effort.
Didn't Frisch also apply the word fission to uranium for the first time?
He did, and he borrowed that term from biology, from the action of a cell splitting. And that was the closest metaphor he could come to this rather extraordinary phenomena that was going on inside the uranium atom.
Where did most of the uranium used to build the atomic bombs that we dropped on Japan at the end of World War II come from?
This, too, I think, is one of the extraordinary stories of science. And this story, I think, has largely gone untold as to how the United States cornered the world supply of uranium in the 1940s. We essentially got control of a mine deep in the heart of what was then Belgian Congo, a place called Shinkalabwe. This mine produced uranium of an intensely pure quality. The ore quality was amazing. Nothing like it has been found ever since.
And so it didn't take as much work to extract it from the things it was fused to.
That's correct. And the diplomacy and the secrecy by which we were able to get the exclusive on this uranium was truly one of the feats of World War II.
The Germans had their own supply of uranium, didn't they?
They did. They did. And it's still a matter of controversy as to how close the Nazis came to developing a bomb.
Uh-huh. But they tried to send uranium to Japan at the end of the war, didn't they?
Yeah. They had loaded some of their uranium oxide onto a submarine, which was then surrendered in the middle of the North Atlantic.
So were the Japanese also looking into the possibility of creating some kind of weapon out of uranium?
All the major combatants of World War II were onto this.
It's interesting that everybody realized that this could be used in weaponry, and yet wasn't uranium also used as a dye for a line of plates called Fiesta War?
That's true. That's true, yes.
Why did they do that?
Uranium has an ability to bind with oxygen in such a way that it creates colorful patterns. It's quite an effective dye, and this is what it was used for from the 1600s on. In fact, almost to the Roman Empire.
So were people killing themselves eating on those plates?
No, not necessarily.
What about the story that I heard when I was a kid that the people who painted the numbers on watches, the watches where the numbers would glow in the dark, were killing themselves because they were using radioactive material?
That's true. That happened over in New Jersey. There was a radium factory where the mostly women workers were using a liquid solution of radium and using it to paint their fingernails. They would lick the brushes much the same way that we lick our fingers to turn pages of a book. And There was a high fatality rate in that factory.
A listener wants to know why it's safe to live in Hiroshima and Nagasaki now if the half-life of uranium is 4.5 million years.
There's no uranium there anymore.
It was just pulled out completely?
Yeah, it was destroyed in the explosion of the bomb.
And uranium also has had medical uses, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's true. In fact, this is one of the breakthroughs that Marie and Pierre Curie had come across, is that these radioactive elements up there on the high level of the periodic table can kill cancer cells, and this is the root today of radiation therapy.
Now, you mentioned the enrichment of uranium. We hear about centrifuges playing a major role in that. Why are centrifuges needed?
You have to separate that 235 from 238, and one of the pathways to doing that is to spin it at a rate that approaches the speed of sound. And getting this right is, thankfully for civilization, very difficult to achieve. It's got to be done in a very precise way. And what it does is it essentially spins the 235 towards the center. It's just a fraction of a microscopic unit lighter than 238.
And what happens to the other three protons?
Pardon?
What happens to the other three protons?
The other three protons, the 235 and 238 are in that ore. and the 238 spins out to the edges. They're present in uranium ores, no 236 or 237.
We also heard about yellowcake uranium, especially in the lead-up to the war in Iraq. They said that they were trying to buy yellowcake from Niger. Is that a special kind of uranium?
Yellowcake is a form of uranium that's the chemical symbol is U308, and it is yellow in color, and it's a very stable way to concentrate it and transport it. And yes, it did play a large role in our casus belli in going to war against Iraq.
And why is it easy to transport?
Pardon?
Why is it easy to
transport? Why is it easy to transport? It's like any other mineral. It's at that stage, it's far from being anything that could be used in a bomb.
Because when you consider that just a small amount of uranium can cause such a huge explosion, you'd think that it would be a dangerous thing. I realize that you got to set the thing in motion. You got to, but still, we're talking about something that has incredible radiation capabilities, and yet it's held in check in yellowcake.
It is. I mean, a crude analogy might be that it's like comparing grape juice to wine. You know, there's a number of steps that you need to take.
My guest is Tom Zollner, Zollner. His book, Uranium, War, Energy, and the Rock That Shaped the World, is published by Viking. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We invite you to check out our video section where you can take a peek inside our studios with guests like Mikhail Baryshnikov and Mark Bittman. Just click on video pics on our show page at WNYC.org. We're back with Tom Zollner, who's written a book called Uranium, War, Energy, and the Rock That Shaped the World. It's published by Viking. You write that at least 50 cases of uranium and other radioactive material had been confiscated around the capital of Kinshasa in the Democratic Republic of Congo in the last 8 years. Even more was going undetected. Do we know where all of that uranium was going?
We don't, but we do know where it was coming from, which was Shinkawabwe. And this is one of the tremendous historical ironies of present day.
The same mine that provided the uranium for the two bombs that we dropped on
Exactly.
Japan.
The same place where we got the uranium to end World War II. This mine is still open. It's relatively unguarded. I went in there myself, actually, without challenge. And much of the uranium ore from this cut in the earth is smuggled out of the Congo to places unknown.
And nobody's been able to trace it, whether it's going to countries or terrorist groups?
There are suspicions that Iran may have been trying to acquire some of this Congolese uranium. I have heard fingers pointed towards – I guess you can't really hear a finger being pointed, but I've heard suspicions that North Korea was the ultimate source. The fact is we just don't know.
And earlier that the alleged Israeli atomic bomb?
The Israeli bomb never used uranium from the Congo. That much of the uranium there was taken from the Negev Desert.
Oh, so it just pops up all over the world?
Yeah, it's a very common element. There's uranium inside the human body. There's uranium that surrounds us on all sides. It's scattered everywhere.
Although I don't want anybody mining uranium for my body. Where did the Pakistanis get their uranium? Where did the Indians get theirs?
That's an excellent question, actually, with the source of Pakistani uranium.
We don't know.
We do know, yes. There are mines in Pakistan.
Uh-huh. And India probably has some, too.
Yeah, India is much more rich in a fissile ore called thorium. And they are what's called a non-signatory to the non-proliferation treaty. And they are a nuclear nation. And they are ironically short on uranium. And so this is one of the controversial decisions of the Bush administration was to enter into an agreement to sell uranium to the Indian government.
But it was the Indian bomb that led Pakistan to pursue a program to build its own bomb. Benazir Bhutto's father, I guess, was the one who started in the 1970s, and that's led to all sorts of other problems,
yeah,
hasn't it? Most recently, A.Q. Khan being released from custody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a regional arms race with implications that went far beyond the India-Pakistan rivalry.
And how would a bomb like Pakistan's be put together? Is it true, what I've read, that it was pretty much based on stolen secrets from here, there, and everywhere else?
Yeah, that's true. The story of AQ Khan is really sort of one disaster after another, but he was able to steal secrets from a lab in the Netherlands, the Urenco lab, and was essentially able to figure out how Pakistan could enrich enough uranium to build that nation's bomb. And he was also the one who convinced the Pakistani government to take that uranium path to the bomb instead of the plutonium path.
Well, I guess many people probably know how to build a bomb. It's one thing to know how to build it, another thing to actually build it. How complicated is that next step, and how expensive?
By far the most complicated part of building an atomic weapon is enriching the uranium. Once you get beyond that point, once you can create what's known as highly enriched uranium, that is to say uranium that is more than 20% pure with U-235, then it becomes really a kind of a matter of garage mechanics at that point.
And so the garage mechanics was something that Pakistan could employ and then pass on to North Korea?
Yeah, and that's one of the things that AQ Khan was able to do. He and some of his fellow scientists in Pakistan essentially operated what's been called a nuclear Walmart, going to state actors across the world and selling not just the enrichment technology, but also the bomb technology.
Well, since uranium is more common than tin, nearly 500 times more abundant than gold, I would think that it would be pretty easy for any country that wanted it to get it.
Yeah, and this is part of the reason why this sense that Saddam Hussein was attempting to acquire uranium from Niger, was patently ridiculous, really. There was no reason for Iraq to have taken that step.
Because it could have gotten it elsewhere.
Yeah, it's not that hard to acquire.
So why is it so hard for Iran to get past the point of enriching enough uranium to create its own bomb?
That has less to do with uranium acquisition and more to do with their ability to enrich that ore that they have.
Why is that? After all they had to do is go to AQ Khan.
AQ Khan to...
He was ready to sell to everybody, he and his and the people who worked for him.
Right, the technology, but not what's called the highly enriched uranium.
You said that it's really garage mechanics.
To build that bomb, yeah.
So I'm amazed more people haven't done it then.
Well, they have to get a hold of that uranium, which, again, thankfully for the state of civilization, is a tough thing to do.
Uh-huh. This is not a matter of just slamming two pieces of uranium into each other.
It is, actually. And you just described the essential architecture of a crude uranium bomb. But, again, it involves the enriched uranium.
There was a time if the hydrogen bomb actually needed a uranium bomb to set it off.
That's true. The heat that's required to fuse two hydrogen nuclei requires an intense furnace that only an atomic weapon can provide.
Now, for a long time, especially during the 50s when Eisenhower was president, there was talk about using nuclear energy for peace. And he thought that we could build a canal, for example, by detonating a bunch of bombs. That would have set off an incredible amount of radiation, wouldn't it?
Yeah. You're talking about something called Project Plowshare, which is really one of the more sort of fantastic chapters in the 1950s view of nuclear science. The atomic weapons were seen as tools for constructing highways, building harbors, even creating hot water for springs. A number of these weapons were detonated underground, and there were even plans to make the Panama Canal wider by setting off a chain of atomic weapons all at once. And this program was thankfully finally discredited.
Would there be a way to come up with a clean nuclear device?
A clean nuclear device?
A device that wouldn't wind up spreading radiation. Or in the case of nuclear energy, leaving us with nuclear waste that has that presents real problems for millions of years to come.
So as I understand it, the notion of a clean nuclear weapon or completely clean nuclear energy is a contradiction in terms.
Mm-hmm. And we have yet to figure out what to do with nuclear waste.
That is an unsolved problem, and the Obama administration has recently taken steps to end our expansion of the Yucca Mountain Waste Facility in Nevada. So the prognosis for nuclear power is very hazy.
Now, what would even happen in that Yucca facility? We would be storing nuclear waste supposedly in vats that wouldn't allow for any leakage.
Well, yeah, and this
is that possible? We're talking about something very volatile.
We're talking about a facility that has to have the seismology and the hydrology and the overall sound architecture to last more than a million years is what the requirement is.
Hmm. And we would hope that people a million years from now would understand danger, keep out.
Right, exactly. There's some kind of universal symbol for that.
My guest is Tom Zollner. His book, Uranium, War, Energy, and the Rock That Shaped the World, is published by Viking. Niger, I like to pronounce it that way, is the fourth largest producer of uranium in the world. But you write that it sees no financial benefit from producing it all that much. Why?
Unfortunately, very little. And this is one of the cases of...
We're talking about one of the poorest countries on the planet.
We are. And we're talking about a very rich nation in terms of its wealth in uranium. And this is a sad case of the resource curse, which so often afflicts African nations, and that their colonizing powers have set up a method of trade that does not remunerate the country where the minerals come from.
But does that mean that there is illegal trade in uranium from Niger?
Not that I have seen documented. Now, I went out to the uranium fields in Niger. They're up north, kind of close to the Sahara. This is where Saddam Hussein was supposedly trying to acquire that uranium from the French company, which we now know did not happen. But something interesting is going on there, which is a revolt. The Tuareg who live there are upset about a number of things, including the bad deal that Niger gets from the uranium. And they have started to do kidnappings and murders, and some of that was going on when I was there.
Selling most of its uranium to France, which uses much of it to power its nuclear power plants.
That's correct, yeah. And France is a nation for whom 80% of their electrical infrastructure comes from uranium. And so when you see the Eiffel Tower bathed in light, there's a excellent chance that what you're seeing is the byproduct of Sahara uranium.
So what is your assessment of uranium for electric power? Many people tout it as the way to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. John McCain touted it during his presidential campaign. Others say that nuclear waste problem is something that at this moment is insurmountable, and we have all of that those areas that have been despoiled around weapons development facilities and the like that are requiring millions and millions and billions of dollars, I guess, for cleanup.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this recent presidential campaign saw both candidates coming out in support of nuclear power. Obama, a little bit more reserved.
Well, he seemed to be coming kicking and screaming because he didn't know how to deal with the accusations that he was slow on it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the stimulus package, actually, that was recently signed into law contains no provisions for loan guarantees to nuclear power plants. And so certainly the indication from the Obama administration is that this is not going to be, at least in the short term, a major part of our energy strategy.
Well, how much of it is scattered around the United States? You write that you grew up around nuclear silos.
I did, yeah. I grew up in Tucson, Arizona, just down the road. My high school was just down the road from a warhead, a Titan II missile pointed somewhere in Russia. And, it was there on the side of the highway. You saw it behind barbed wire. And so I and obviously anyone else who was coming of age during that time, the early to late 80s, was under the shadow, as we have been since Hiroshima, of a potential kind of a secular Armageddon, if you will.
But that wasn't dangerous, was it?
The missile underground?
Yeah.
Only if it was shot off. Then we'd be in trouble.
Well, where is all that stuff now?
Decommissioned. And in fact...
What does decommissioned mean? We still have the nuclear material, don't we?
The highly enriched uranium, yes. That was taken out. And here, this is one of the kind of undersung stories of the end of the Cold War, is that we made a deal with Russia, with Yeltsin's Russia, to essentially buy the highly enriched uranium that was in their nuclear warheads and use it in our civilian nuclear industry. And we bought so much of this. This was called the Megatons to Megawatts program, that there was a 1 in 5 chance that whenever you turned on the light, you were using electricity that was coming from a decommissioned Soviet warhead, which had once been pointed at the United States. Really, one of the myriad ironies surrounding this mineral that just keeps continuing to mount.
So we were using the Soviet enriched uranium, but not our own?
The Department of Energy actually has and will continue to sell off some of the American stockpile of uranium to the civilian electricity industry.
Because a dozen years ago, the U.S. Department of Energy try to make a complete inventory of all the highly enriched uranium the United States had manufactured through the Cold War. What did they find?
Here's another irony. We don't know how much of this stuff exists. We don't know how much highly enriched uranium there is out there in the world. And not only do the Russians not know how much of it they produced because of poor record keeping, but the United States has not a precise idea of how much there is. And, you know, certainly that's a matter of concern.
Although we still have a huge nuclear bomb superiority over the rest of the world, don't we? I don't know where we would dump the bomb. Is it part of the problem? For example, if a country in the Middle East developed a bomb, let's say Iran developed a bomb and decided to drop it on Israel, wouldn't it wind up suffering as well from nuclear fallout because of proximity?
That's certainly a distinct possibility. For all of its faults, the intellectual cornerstone of the arms race between the United States and the Soviet Union was something called mutually assured destruction, the idea that no rational government was going to want to light this powder keg because of the enormous consequences that would follow. And this is really sort of the logic of schoolyard bullies, but it happened to have worked.
Well, except for certain things like nuclear-powered submarines, although I don't know what we do with the waste from them either, and some medical applications, are there possible positive uses of this in the future?
It's a substance that we're going to have to make our peace with. We dug it up. This is almost a moral question. You know, the greatest cliche of the Cold War was the genie is out of the bottle. In other words, once you have brought uranium into the world, once you have this this knowledge, you can't unlearn it and you cannot rebury it.
And many people argue that we're unlikely to face, if there is a nuclear attack, it would not be from a bomb, but it would be from some kind of a dirty nuclear device. Is that possible today?
It certainly is. It certainly is.
And why do you think we haven't seen one?
Well, that's a great question. I can only hope that that lack of use continues.
If you're listening and you're thinking of doing it, please don't do it.
Yes, hold off, please.
But really, you would think that someone like Osama bin Laden would have wanted to do something like this, and perhaps it is harder than we think.
Well, somebody at the International Atomic Energy Agency phrased it to me this way. He said, look, you know, if you get a hold of some, raw uranium, some yellow cake, some fairly benign material, and if you, you know, put explosives around that and set it off in Hyde Park in London, it's going to do, you know, really no damage beyond, you know, whatever explosives you have in there. But the simple fact that uranium has been scattered in a public area is going to create enormous psychological distress.
So there's the psychological factor as well as the actual radiation factor.
Yeah. I mean, this has a certain transgressive quality to it. I mean, there's something so violent inside uranium, something so mysterious and kind of beyond our capabilities to conceive of it or control of it, that it becomes almost a theological matter.
Tom Zollner will be giving a reading and signing books this Thursday at 7 o'clock at the McNally Jackson Bookstore. That's at 50 Prince Street. The book, Uranium, War, Energy, and the Rock That Shaped the World, is published by Viking. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
On tomorrow's show, playwrights and screenwriters Kenneth Lonergan and David Rabe compare the challenges of writing for stage and screen. Plus, a look at urban gardening, then a talk with Zoe Heller about her latest novel, The Believers. And our latest underreported segment takes a look at green job initiatives in New York City. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Alexander Hutz and Miranda Schaefer. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We will see you tomorrow.